I'm up on the tight wire.
I'm not in Studio B today. I'm in Studio A, sitting across from my good friend Benjamin Alida Sines.
And I'm sitting across from my good friend Daniel Chacon.
And welcome to Words on a Wire. Today, our guest is poet Sharon Bryan, whose book Sharp Stars from Boa Editions is really a beautiful book.
Yes, and she'll be reading one of her poems from that book for our Poem of the Week.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that I like about this show is Ben and I just ask people to be on because we like their work. And remember when we first thought about this show, Ben, we were going to call it Book Talk because it was going to be a show about books. So we're very excited to talk about another book that we like.
And this week, our poetic license is from...
Ben will be doing the poetic license this week.
Yes, I will be.
Right now, we're thinking about everybody on the East Coast. Hurricane Sandy, as we're recording this, has landed in New York and wreaking havoc on Manhattan and New Jersey and Connecticut. And so we're pulling for everybody over there.
I think in times of great storms and calamity, another reminder that we all belong to each other, and that is why we read, and that is why we write.
Absolutely. You know, and I got a lot of friends on Facebook who are in New York right now, and it's interesting every now and then to get a post from them. One friend said that she has no power, so she's not going to be on her computer for very long. Every now and then she'll give us updates about how she's doing, but... she wants to conserve her battery, so she keeps turning off the computer. And then Patrick Rosal, who we had on this show, is in Brooklyn right now, and he just made a post on Facebook saying, "Can I drink the water?" sounds quite scary, and we hope everybody gets through that all right. And Sharon Bryan, we're going to be calling her. She's in Boston, and last night she wasn't sure if she was even going to be able to be on the show because of the storm, and she wasn't sure if the buses were going to be running and if she was going to be able to get around. But fortunately, I think she's okay, and I look forward to talking to her. She's a wonderful poet.
She is a wonderful poet, and it should be a great show this week on Words on a Wire.
Absolutely. We'll be right back. Sharon Bryan is the author of the poetry collections Salt Air, Objects of Affection, Flying Blind, and most recently Sharp Stars, which won the Isabella Stewart Gardner Poetry Award. She is editor of Where We Stand, Women Poets on the Literary Tradition, and Planet on the Table, Poets on the Reading Life, which she co-edited with William Olson. She has been a visiting professor at the University of Connecticut and Dartmouth College and is currently teaching graduate seminars at Emerson College in Boston. Thank you, Sharon, for being on the show.
Welcome.
I'm delighted to be here. I like the title. I don't know if you had Leonard Cohen in mind.
No, I don't think we did.
No, but you know what? Now that you mention it, I love Leonard Cohen.
Well, and he has that wonderful song, Birds on a Wire.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. No, we use, for our theme song, we use "I'm Up on the Higher Wire."
Right. Yeah, I actually heard it when I listened to the Phil Levine interview you did, which was wonderful.
Oh, cool. Thanks. Yeah. And I would like to start off, first of all, making sure you're okay. You're in Boston right now, and the storm Sandy is, as we record this, is playing havoc on the East Coast. Everything's okay in Boston, though, I understand.
Yeah, it's actually past us, and it was more, the worst part here was the nonstop coverage. It was really boring after a while. but it sounds awful in New York.
Yeah,
I was just last night, I reread this wonderful essay by E.B. White called The Eye of Edna. And even though he wrote it in the 50s, it was incredibly familiar because he's living in Maine and there's this huge hurricane coming up the coast and he's listening on the radio. And it's much worse on the radio than it ever. And it doesn't match up. By the time it gets to him, of course, they're way on to other things on the radio and when trees are blowing down in his yard in Maine. So.
Are you inspired by the storm in any way to write model in poetry?
No.
That's probably good.
I mean, not that I can tell, unless it's very delayed and indirect. No, I mean, I feel I have friends in New York and New Jersey that I've been touching base with, but so it's a very big deal in New York.
Yeah, absolutely.
Horrible.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about Sharp Stars.
Okay.
That's your latest book. It's put out by BOA. I'm going to start off by telling you what I love about your poetry and specifically in this book.
Right?
I love your syntax. I love how your sentences carry us all the way to the very end before they drop even a hint of sentido or completion. It makes the poem so effortless to read. You just follow the sentence, and you don't know where it's going to go, and then it lets you off. And it's that ambiguity in between as you're getting to the end of the sentence where a lot of the poetry happens. You must love writing sentences.
What you said is really interesting to me because I never thought about it quite that way. I know there was a point where I started postponing ending the sentence. I mean, not even that consciously, and using a lot more commas and dashes as a way to resist the sentence, I think. And in fact, somebody just sent me an anthology called One for the Money, The Sentence as a Poetic Form, where all the poems in it are a single sentence, and it includes a poem from Sharp Stars called White Space.
Oh, yes, I like that poem.
And the truth is, I hadn't really noticed that it was one sentence, but it is. And I think it is something about the postponement, not wanting to stop.
Yeah, in fiction, we call it writing suspenseful or periodic sentences where, you know, you don't reveal the heart of the sentence in the first clause. You kind of keep it, and then you know,
exactly.
And it drives the forward.
Maybe that's in the back of my mind someplace, because I mean, Proust is a big favorite because he does those sentences.
Do you sometimes not know where the sentence is going to go and you just kind of have faith and follow it?
I would say never.
Really?
Yeah, that's a lot of the pleasure of writing for me is that I really feel like I'm listening and writing down what the poem tells me to. And, I mean, when I'm not doing that, if I'm just talking, it's bad.
Right.
I don't like the sound of my own voice, so I'm waiting. And it does interrupt, you know, when you're working on a draft and you don't know where to go next, then my voice starts to talk, and that's never very interesting. The poem, I feel like, knows so much more than I do that that's what I want to get down. So no, I don't know where it's going. That's the pleasure.
Yeah, in the poem called Poem, you write, "I don't know what I am or what I want until I hear myself say it to her." And, of course, you're speaking to the poem itself in that line. Does speaking the poem help you figure things out?
Oh, totally. Totally. I think somewhere in the back of my mind when I wrote that was my wonderful Uncle Don, who died a few years ago. And whenever we'd all go out to dinner together and somebody would say to him, "What are you going to have?" he would say, "I don't know till I hear myself order it." and I feel like that, and I feel like often, in fact, if I do sometimes have a sense of where, of what I believe or think, a lot of times the poem just turns on me and makes me realize, oh no, I don't really believe that. I can't, there's something about truth-telling in poems. Not the facts, but other kinds of truth. That's where I can most tell what it is, what's accurate, so that if I try to just put something in a poem that's there are times when I think I know where it's going, and then the poem just spits that out.
Well, I think it's interesting because I think that as I hear you talk and I think about your poems, then it sounds like you put two opposite things. You're trying to put two opposite things together and then hold them both at once. It sounds like you lose yourself in words and then find yourself in them.
That's a wonderful description. I can't imagine a better description of writing poems.
Yeah, and I think about your poem, Bad Days.
Yeah.
Which I love that poem.
Oh.
And I think it could have been this incredibly misanthropic poem, and yet it isn't.
Really? You don't think it is in places?
No. But overall, no. The overall, of course it is in places. Of course. But I don't think the poem is actually saying we should have never been born. We should have never been. I think the poem is actually saying, oddly enough, we should take a look at our own history and maybe start again in a place where you end the poem. It says, before farming, before we lived in caves or spoke or discovered fire, lift us off our feet and into the trees and leave us there, harmlessly eating fruit, not even poking anthills with bits of straw. Before any discovery at all, so maybe you want to get us back to some kind of original innocence. And I love that impulse. It's very generous at the end of this poem. How did you write that poem?
I think it's sort of an unusual poem for me, though I kind of think I'm going to be writing more. Anger's never been a big driving force in poems for me. I've never known how to write out of it. But there are several angry poems in this book. And, like Barking Dog isn't where I complain about.
That's a fun poem.
But the anger in this poem is fear. You know, that's something I haven't written a lot out of. And there are days when I do just despair, that when I actually find myself wishing that, when I feel like humans are going to destroy the planet, and given a choice, I'd rather we destroyed ourselves first.
Exactly.
But it breaks my heart. Maybe that's what comes through in the end, that finally overwhelms the anger, is the sadness.
Yes.
It's just heartbreaking that I kind of can't believe it, that we would do that.
Let me ask you about your, go back to Sharp Stars' book that I really love. The poems are very quiet. They're very quiet. I noticed you write a lot of them in couplets. And I'm wondering if that is a form that just kind of comes to you, or is it something that you're comfortable with? Or tell us about that.
I like couplets because I like all the white space. Half of the poem is silent. A third of the poem is silent. And I like that. I always feel like I talk too much. So one of the things I love about poetry is it makes me leave stuff out. And writing in couplets is, you can't be too chatty because all that white space makes every word stand out.
That makes sense.
It helps me get the clutter out. It's one of the ways it functions. So that even tercets, the three-line stanzas, feel a little, I'm always a little nervous. Am I talking too much?
In some of your poems, you indent the second line. You'll have the first line, which is all the way to the left, and then the second line, the line that comes after that, is indented for three or four spaces, and then you go back and forth, and you indent every other line. For people who don't know poetry very well, what effect does that indention have on the rhythm or on the reading of the poem?
I was thinking that the only ones where I do that, I wish I would move stuff around more on the page. I feel kind of timid about that, and as if I'm clinging to something, that left-hand margin. In this book, there are several poems that are in three-line stanzas where each of the three lines is indented. It's a kind, Carlos Williams used that. Mm-hmm. That's a form on the page I really like because it's feels and looks very musical to me. Mm-hmm. And it's almost as if each stanza is a line, but the line keeps stepping down. So, or it feels kind of dancey to me. Anyway, it's a form I like. I haven't used it much, but I did just notice that a poem called Soda.
Right, that was the one I was thinking of.
Yeah, which is really where the title of the book comes from.
Yes.
I don't know how that happened. Actually, I can't remember.
Would it be read differently if it wasn't indented? Like, for example, you have this, "Only now do I see that the air is full of small, sharp stars pinwheeling through every living thing. that gets in their way. Does the indention cause the reader to read it differently?
It matters to me. I think there's a big difference between the voice reading in our heads when we're reading on the page.
Right.
And what, you know, probably there's no difference if I read that out loud. But that white space at the beginning of each indented line matters to me.
Well, also, it's visually pushing us forward.
Yeah. But there's also kind of more, it's like a double line break in a way, because there's white space
this
is the line, and then there's more white space. So each line is set off more by the white space. So I think of it as more both pushing forward, but there's also more of a pause. So I guess I have a sense that it's more, in a way, more thinking out loud.
Is Sharp Stars, did you set out to write a book, or were you just writing poems and then after a while, you realized you had a book?
No, I think very much in terms of books, because I like that. Years ago, I said to a novelist friend of mine, how can you work on something that big and that long? And she said, how can you start over every day?
I thought, oh, touché.
Isn't that great?
Yeah.
And I hate starting over every day. So I figured that out early on. After the first book, that was a complete miscellany, the way I think a lot of first books are.
Right.
I thought, man, I don't like this. And after that, I had more of a sense of, I know James Tate once talks about going into a mine and finding a vein of ore and following that until it's exhausted, and then he has a book. But I like book-length poems. It helps me enormously to have a sort of approach or something I'm thinking about or working on, a vein on mining. So I think totally in terms of books at this point.
And I do, too. I'm really happy to hear you say that. And maybe it's because I also write novelists, but my poems are not narrative, but there is a narrative arc that ties the book together, and I think that's important.
Right.
It's one of the reasons I love C.D. Wright.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah. We had her on the show.
Deep Step Come Shining is one of the best books I've ever read.
Right.
Me too.
Me too.
Gorgeous, and it's just haunting, and it takes a whole book. So I love working that way. This book was, I actually took a break from writing poems. I had a big tantrum at one point. I had written Flying Blind. I couldn't get it published. It took 5 years to get it published. I knew it was a lot better than the first two books. And before I could get Flying Blind published, the first two books went out of print. So, I mean, you know, it happens to most poets, but I thought, well, I devoted my life to poets. I was also living in Memphis and very unhappy about that. And I thought, wow, I devoted my life to this, and look where it got me. I'm not going to do it anymore. My brilliant idea was that I was going to somehow write for money.
Oh, yeah.
I haven't figured that out yet, but that was my thought.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll write for money. And I just stopped writing poems. And I didn't know if I would ever start writing poems again. It wasn't, I just thought, that's okay, I'm not going to do that. I wrote everything else, including prose poems, but I wasn't going to go near that poetry stuff. And then there was a point where I wasn't even reading a lot of poetry. Then I started reading it again. And then it was really kind of strange. There was a week, actually a day, when I thought, wait a minute, I wrote three poems this week. So Sharp Stars is a book of joy. There's a lot of sorrow and grief in the book before it, because three friends of mine had died within 2 years of each other. So Flying Blind has a lot of sadness. But Sharp Stars, I mean, the cover art is called Joy Sparks of the Gods. It's a painting by Hans Hoffman. And it's that incredible pleasure of being back living in words again. It's just so easy to get distracted by the wrong stuff, I think.
We'd like to read a poem every week, and when we have a poet on the show, we'd like to ask them to read. Would you read one of your poems from Sharp Stars?
Sure. Do you want to pick? I'll read anything.
Body and Soul is good.
Body and Soul. Let's do that one, yeah.
Okay. Body and Soul. They grow up together, but they aren't even fraternal twins. They quarrel a lot about where to go and what to do. The body complains about having to carry the soul everywhere, as if it were some helpless cripple. And the soul snipes that it can go places the body never dreamed of. Then they quarrel over which one of them does the dreaming. But the truth is, they can't live without each other, and they both know it. Anima, animosity. The diaphragm pumps like a bellows, and the soul pulls out all the stops. Sings at the top of its lungs, laughs at its little jokes. It would like to think it has the upper hand and can leave whenever it wants. But only as long as it knows the door will be unlocked when it sneaks back home before the sun comes up. And when the body says, "Where have you been?" the soul says with a smirk, "I was at the end of my tether." And it was like a diver on the ocean floor or an astronaut admiring the view from outside the mothership. And like them, it would be lost without its air supply and protective clothing. The body knows that and begins to hum, "I get along without you very well." And the soul says, "Listen to that. You can't sing worth a lick without me." They'll go on bickering like this until death do them part. And then, even if the soul seems to float above the body for a moment, like a flame above a candle, once you pinch the wick, it disappears.
That was Sharon Bryan reading Body and Soul
from her book Sharp Stars, winner of the Isabella Gardner Poetry Award in 2009.
Thank you, Sharon, for joining us on Words on a Wire.
Oh, it's been nothing but a pleasure.
Gratitude. So I was driving down the freeway yesterday, and I was running a little late. Running a little late seems to be a recurring theme in my life, a little like my recurring dreams. I'm temporarily living on the east side of El Paso, and I'm not used to driving in traffic. I'm really not into cars and traffic and freeways. On my best days, I'm not exactly what anyone would call a good driver. But if I pay attention, stay focused, and keep my eyes on the road and my side mirrors, I'm adequate, though all my stickers are expired. At a certain point, the traffic came to a standstill. A phone call came in on my cell phone. It was from the National Democratic Party. And could I give money? I had enough time to whip out my credit card, make a desperation donation before Election Day, and get thanked by what sounded like a very young and enthusiastic man. The traffic got going again. Someone cut in front of me. I thought awful things about this person. Did I tell you I like to cuss? But then I got to thinking about the voice of that sweet, enthusiastic young man who's manning phones for a cause he believes in. And I thought, how lovely. Really. And then I got to thinking about my job. I know. I should have been thinking about the traffic and my driving, but I couldn't help it. There I was, thinking about my job, and I thought, here I have this job, and I'm surrounded by young people who want to learn how to write essays and stories and novels and poems. Their beautiful and sincere desire to write something that matters is nothing short of a miracle in this crazed, violent, confusing, and fractured world of ours. I pictured them, the faces of some of my students. I studied their curious and hungry faces. And then I pictured the smile on my own face. What a lucky man I am to be able to teach poetry, to be surrounded by good and decent people who care about beauty and art and literature and want to lead reflective lives. And then that phrase, reflective lives, well, it led me back to a book I've been reading. It's a famous book entitled Walden Pond. I don't know exactly what led me back to read that book again, but I think it has something to do with the fact that when we are in need of something, when there is a hunger inside us that needs feeding, we go back to our teachers. Henry David Thoreau just happens to be one of my teachers. He wrote, "I see young men, my townsmen, whose misfortune it is to have inherited farms, houses, barns, cattle, and farming tools, for these are more easily acquired than got rid of. Better if they had been born in the open pasture and suckled by a wolf, that they might have seen with clear eyes what field they were called to labor in. Who made them serfs of the soil? Why should they eat their 60 acres when man is condemned to eat only his peck of dirt? Why should they begin digging their graves as soon as they are born? They have got to live a man's life, pushing all these things before them, and get on as well as they can. How many a poor immortal soul have I met, well nigh crushed and smothered under its load, creeping down the road of life, pushing before it is barn 75 feet by 40, its Augean stables never cleansed, and 100 acres of land, tillage, mowing, pasture, and woodlot. The portionless who struggle with no such unnecessary inherited encumbrances find it labor enough to subdue and cultivate a few cubic feet of flesh. But men labor under a mistake. The better part of the man is soon plowed into the soil for compost. By a seeming fate, commonly called necessity, they are employed, as it says in an old book, laying up treasures which moth and rust will corrupt, and thieves break through and steal. It is a fool's life, as they will find when they get to the end of it, if not before. I love that idea of subduing and cultivating a few cubic feet of flesh, subduing and cultivating our minds, our hearts, our bodies. Maybe that's exactly what we're doing when we teach and when we write. No one can steal that kind of labor away from us. Today, I live in gratitude. I'm grateful for my job. I'm a professor. I teach. I'm a writer. I write. I think it will take me a lifetime to subdue and cultivate this chaotic and untamable heart of mine. But I am grateful to be engaged in such a labor.
That was Benjamin Alida Sines sharing his thoughts about gratefulness and gratitude. Thank you, Ben. That was beautiful.
My pleasure. Thanks for listening to another edition of Words on a Wire. We'd like to thank our guest today, Sharon Bryan. And we'd also like to thank her for reading that lovely poem that she read for us.
And we'd like to thank you, Ben, for sharing those wonderful, inspiring words with us. Join us next week when we have, as our guest, Mark Strand, Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, former U.S. Poet Laureate, and really one of my poetry gurus. I've always read this guy. I think he's fantastic, and I'm really excited about getting him on the show.
Mark Strand is everybody's poetry guru. We're really looking forward to having him on our show.
So see you next week. I'm Daniel Chacon.
And I'm Benjamin Alire Sines.
And don't forget, the next book you read
may save your life.
I'm up on the tie wire. One side's ice and one is fire. It's a circus game with you and me. I'm up on a tightrope. One side's hate and one is hope. But the top half.